Hi and welcome to Demystify Technology. My name is Tim Rodenbrücker, and in this podcast, I try to find out what we can learn from the past to design the future. Based on the premise that technology itself is charged with myths that prevent holistic creativity and sustainable innovation, I speak to thinkers and makers to dream up a future of technological wisdom and simplicity. Chris De Decker, super nice to have you here in this conversation. Awesome. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Tim.
Where are you right now? You are I can see you. The listeners cannot see you, but you are in a workshop or something.
Yeah, I'm in my workshop in Barcelona, in Clot. So yeah, it's a shared workshop. So I cannot guarantee that the background remains silent, but it's siesta time, so it should work for now.
Yeah, we can hear you well, and we can take a little break if it's going too loud. Awesome. Yeah, I know the Akasha Hub where you are right now. It's a really nice place. Since when do you go there to work?
I think I'm here like 2 years and a half.
Is this the place where you write as well? Or do you write in work, or do you go somewhere else for that?
Well, my personal life kind of changed. So at the moment, I'm basically living here, except I'm not sleeping here. So I'm also... coincidentally, I just built with my colleague Marie, we just built some kind of slow cooking devices that run on solar power, and they're standing here next to me. So I'm also here to do continuous experiments with these cookers, making lunch, making dinner.
Nice.
It's kind of, at the moment, it's a bit my home. Mm-hmm. And I just go sleep somewhere at night.
Mm-hmm. All right. Cool. Awesome. Some years ago, 2 years ago, I've been also living in Barcelona, and we made this event. You organized it. I was a guest there. We discussed the future of the internet. The title was Back to the Future of the Internet. Yeah. Many things changed in between. This is at least my feeling, not to the better, but to the worse. But anyway, what I loved about this this event was its utopian spirit, and I would love to speak with you about an utopian internet today, or an utopian use of computer technology, communication technologies, based on the things that we had already in the past. So tell us a little bit about your blog. How does it exactly work? It's running on a solar-powered web server, right?
Yeah, so I started Low Tech Magazine in 2007, which was before social media. And then I made it with kind of this blog software that's called TypePad. It's very old-school thing. It still exists, although I don't really have the feeling that people still maintain it, but... It's actually a paid solution. It's not open source. And it was like Blogger or kind of this in the 2000s, you had all these platforms where you could make your own blog, and either you paid or you allowed advertisements next to your content. And they offered you kind of both the software and the hosting. So it was a very easy way to start your own blog. Almost as simple as making a social media profile. And so, because it was just after I moved from Belgium to Spain, and I was a freelance journalist at that time for like newspapers and magazines, which was already not really making me happy in the sense that I worked a lot and I earned very little. They treat you very bad. Mm-hmm. And then moving to Spain made it even more challenging to keep working for them. So I decided, I have nothing to lose. I just start publishing my articles for free on the internet rather than selling them to newspapers and see what happens. And the great thing about that period is that you needed very little. I paid, I think, 15 euros a month. And I had my own publication where there was no limit to traffic and everything. And then it kind of quickly caught on. Mm-hmm. So I got on some big websites like Slashdot and things like that.
The Oil and Drum as well, right?
Yeah, the Oil Drum was also around the time, 2008, 9, 10. Mm-hmm. So it was the kind of, because we didn't have social media, what you did is that, for instance, you gave comments on other people's blogs, and then people got to know you. And the big hope was that some bigger site kind of saw your article and then linked to it. So it was this kind of, they still exist. Like now, nowadays you have Hacker News, Slashdot also still exists, but it kind of changed a bit, quite a while. A bit, and then you kind of and another way was to kind of in your articles you linked to content of other people, and you knew that these people were watching their statistics, their web statistics, and they saw like, hey, there is traffic coming in from that website, and then they go have a look and then they get to know you. So it was this whole kind of manual way of getting yourself noticed without all the likes and the shares and everything, but it worked in a very similar way, basically. And so I maintained this blog software for until like 2018, and then we made, by that time, yeah, Low Tech Magazine was already like more than 10 years old, and then I got this offer from two design students from the US, from a famous design school, and they offered me to make a more beautiful website. They found my website ugly and I'm like unprofessional, which it was. But we kind of, that project became much more than making a more attractive blog. It became more of an investigation, like, can you actually make websites more sustainable, like or low tech or whatever you call it. And so, yeah, that took some time and effort, but eventually we came up with a website that is indeed solar powered, but more importantly that it's very lightweight, and so it kind of reverses the trend towards ever more bells and whistles and heavier content.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Maybe let's go back for a second back to this time when everything was based on blogs, right? Blogs are amazing. I think blogs are a wonderful technology. There was this concept that you mentioned in your talk called link love. That means you link to a friend that you find this content you admire, and you set a link maybe in your, I think there's also something called a web ring or a blog row where people mention blogs they find attractive and nice. And that is also
exactly.
Yeah. That's an amazing blog row, concept.
Yeah, the blog row was another way to kind of get yourself noticed with people who did similar things. That you just in like the side column or in a on a separate page, you just link all the blogs that you think are interesting and somehow related to what you are doing.
Yes.
And so it was one of the first things you did in those times, that when you discovered a new interesting blog. I mean, everyone had blogs those days, like, I don't know, some professor in architectural urban design starts a blog, and that was super interesting because these people had very specific knowledge. And, yeah, the first thing you did was check their blog row, because there you're going to find more stuff that is related to what they write about. And so this whole idea of social media, like, I see the advantages, but you could build something very similar that is based on blogs. In the end, there's social media. Just what the main change is that we gave out. We no longer own our content.
Yes.
We don't use our own pages anymore, because, and that's a big problem.
Yeah.
So, for example, I learned it the hard way, like when Facebook came up. And then Twitter and all these social media platforms, you start building a following. So in the end, I think I got like 15,000 Facebook followers. I got 15,000 Twitter followers. And then Facebook started asking me money to reach them. So there you notice like, oops, you kind of, you locked yourself up in their ecosystem. And then they either say, well, or you're going to pay now to reach your followers, or you're out. And there's no way to take your followers to another platform. And then Twitter was when Musk took it over, and it became this kind of right-wing neo-Nazi network. I also didn't want to be there anymore. So, you lose another 15,000 followers. And with blogs, you didn't have that problem because you could always, you had your newsletter. So every time you published a new article, you send out an email.
Mm-hmm.
And if you switched blogging platform, say you go from Blogger to TypePad or the other way around, you just take your newsletter. So you're platform independent. And that is a huge difference. I know people now who are still on Twitter, for instance, who really wouldn't want to be there anymore, but they have like 200,000 followers. So mm-hmm. you either destroy everything you built up in the last 15, 20 years.
Yes.
Or you comply and you stay on a network that you basically disagree with being there.
Absolutely. Do you find it still dilemmatic? I mean, Low Tech Magazine as well is on Instagram. I don't know if you use X anymore, and I don't know if you use the Fediverse, but how dilemmatic do you find it to be there? I mean, I'm dealing with this now, and I'm really, really, I'm kind of, you know, I have two different, it's schizophrenic. So what's your take on this?
Yeah, of course it's difficult because the best thing on one hand would be like, okay, you just stop all the social media, but then you're kind of, nobody knows what you're doing anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Twitter, I still have the account, but it's archived, so I don't publish anymore. I kept it because I don't want anyone else to take over the Low Tech Magazine name and then start publishing things that are very different.
Sure.
Facebook, I also stopped publishing because I don't want to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Zuckerberg is rich enough.
Mm-hmm.
And Instagram, so when we kind of stopped these two, I decided to put more effort on LinkedIn. So that's where mm-hmm. I had an account already, but I didn't really use it. And so now I use it more.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marie, who is much younger than I and who joined Low Tech Magazine 2020. Yeah, she's very much the Instagram generation. So she took over that account. And so Instagram became our main social media channel. But yeah, we publish very, very irregular. It's like maybe once every 1.5 or 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's definitely a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
But I stopped promoting my social media account. So on the website, mm-hmm. I think there is a link to the Instagram. There's no link to the others because I don't want, what I want is that people follow me through the newsletter.
Exactly. Sure.
Because that's what I own. I mean, I can download that list any moment and I can mm-hmm. reach my followers.
Your newsletter, you don't speak about Patreon, but your real newsletter, right?
Yes, it's like an mm-hmm. email newsletter that mm-hmm. is free to subscribe.
Yeah.
And then the Patreon is more like extra content for people who want to support me financially.
Yeah.
But the newsletter is for free and the website also. So when I started in 2007, the paywall was very much not existing. So
yeah,
all the content was for free.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the last, I don't know, especially in the last 5 years, basically everything became
mm-hmm.
started hiding behind a paywall. And I don't want to do that because I find it weird. I mean, as a writer, you want people to read your stuff. So
mm-hmm.
the last thing you're going to do is put a gate around it.
Yeah.
And then obviously you also want to earn money because otherwise you cannot spend the whole day writing.
Of course.
You have to pay the bills. But I think, and I think I demonstrated that if you focus, if you keep everything free, what you get is a lot of people sharing it and reading it. And from that, eventually, you will make some money in indirect ways.
Exactly.
People invite you for talks or workshops. Or a republication, or they want you to cooperate with a book, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I will never put a paywall around it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you when you have to pay, you also have to give your identity. So I don't think that's necessary, that to read mm-hmm. an article on a news website, that they have to know who you are.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So, and then this is something that I'm very interested in, because I'm also writing a lot now and I'm planning to publish a book at some point. What you did is amazing. You just write your articles, which are free on your website, lowtechmagazine.com. And then you create these printed, the printed website, actually, that was the idea, right? You create a yeah. book out of these blog posts. And that's amazing. I'm a little bit scared to do that because I feel like people would maybe not really be interested in... I had the feeling that people find it weird if something is completely free. It's nothing that they really value, but you seem to have a different impression of that, right? A different experience.
Yeah, in my case, it worked well for several reasons. One is that by the time I started publishing books, I already had an archive of 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine you are someone who just discovers the website and the topic interests you. You're like fascinated by technology and history and stuff like that. And then you see these like 150 articles.
Yeah.
And if you then have the choice between reading them on a screen mm-hmm. or on paper, many people go like, okay, I prefer to read on paper because mm-hmm. it's not very comfortable to read a whole book, like hundreds yeah. of articles on screen.
Yeah, exactly.
And on the, so that really, if I would have started to write, to publish books after 2 years, that would not have worked so well. So mm-hmm. I think that's one reason why it works, because the archive is huge and people just don't want to read it on a screen.
Yeah.
And otherwise, yeah, I don't know. They also, I think people also just buy books to support me, not necessarily all to read them,
mm-hmm.
but to put them on the bookshelf, maybe also to kind of store, to be sure to have the knowledge available if the internet disappears or
mm-hmm.
because that's when actually if everything, if shit hits the fan, as they say, mm-hmm. that's when you need the knowledge of low-tech magazine the most, because it shows you yeah. how to do things without the big infrastructures.
Exactly, exactly.
And so even though my website is solar powered, it's still dependent on the network. So some weeks ago, we had this big blackout in Spain.
And yes.
Unfortunately, I was not here. I was in Brussels, but the website went down. Why? Because it's solar powered, but the router is not solar powered. So it just mm-hmm. went down. And then even if the router would have worked, probably somewhere elsewhere in the network, things were also down. So
mm-hmm.
a book has the obvious advantage of being resilient. Once it's Absolutely. Printed and you have it, it's there. It's there for 500 years. So,
absolutely, that makes total sense. But nevertheless, maybe let's go again one little step back. What I just learned, or what we were speaking about, is actually a blog system, like an ecosystem, an internet based on websites and blogs. And this concept of link love and blog roles is actually a completely big tech independent system, right? So yeah. you don't need anything. You have the social media features by mentioning people that you admire. And you have this way of, like in a Zettel custom, where you go from one information to the other by just surfing the links, right? Yeah. That's an amazing utopian idea, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I think we should try to get back. So rather mm-hmm. than everyone making a profile on social media platform or several, because many people have several profiles, you just make your own blog. And there in the blog role, you put all your friends. And you can also write a post about some other article that someone, or post that someone wrote.
Mm-hmm.
You could, rather than just... Now you do like share or you like, but you could write a very short article about your take on what this other person wrote. And mm-hmm. then you quote, you link to their page, and you give some extra thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And if everybody would do that, we would have a very similar system, in the sense that we're, we could still share a lot of information and things could still get not really viral, but in a different way, you mm-hmm. can still get, I mean, I had more traffic in those days than I have now. So when you got a link okay. from Slashdot, for instance, you got 50,000 people in a day.
Wow.
And wow. So it, the only thing is that it takes a little bit more effort to make your profile.
True.
And that's, of course, convenience. It's the story of modernization. And it's more mm-hmm. convenient, so people just start. Rather than starting their own blog, they just start using, for example, Facebook as their publishing platform.
And there's, what also happens if you create your own blog, there is more quality and less quantity. That means like what we have in social media now is it's an explosion of content. Like yep. everybody like films their food and, show these very things that are actually not important at all, that are all based on the system which tries to make you addicted to being connected in quotes with the world, which you are not actually, right?
Yep.
You are disconnecting yourself from the world actually.
Totally.
So and with blogs, people would put effort into writing articles or maybe sharing photos, maybe even videos, but that would be a completely different quantity, right? And more quality. Yes.
Hmm. Yeah, and so like the problem with the social media is also this feed that kind of is endless.
Yeah.
So when you can publish things, but then you start, that's what the doom scrolling, that's what most people, what I see on the train, everyone's scrolling their Instagram. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a never-ending thing. Mm-hmm. But in the block, the block times, you could do something similar in the sense that you go to your block roll and you click on every link and you see mm-hmm. if something new happened. And actually, you didn't have to do that even because you could put the blocks that you want to follow, mm-hmm. you could put it in an RSS reader.
That
was another mm-hmm. important element of that block, ecosystem. Mm-hmm. That you had a feed reader, where you can, which works very similar in the sense as the feed of a social media platform, but mm-hmm. with the difference that there's no algorithms, and it has an end, because mm-hmm. once that you just add say 30 blocks. And every time they publish a new post, it immediately mm. shows up in your feed reader. Then you click on it, you end up on the blog, or you read it in the feed reader itself. Mm-hmm. But once you reach the end of all the blogs you follow, it's over, and you go do something else. You talk to your family or your friends. Or
exactly.
So there was this. It was very much like now. Internet is kind of continuously. We're on it the whole day. Also because we have smartphones, that's another change in the meantime. They were not mm-hmm. really smartphones in the late 2000s. So people mm-hmm. just were online at specific times, mm-hmm. as I still do because I don't have a smartphone.
I know. Yeah.
So I'm still kind of living in that late 2000 internet world. But I'm also much less online than I used to be. I mean, the whole fun is gone. There's even Google search does not, I mean, you look for something on Google search and you only get crappy results. And it was not, mm-hmm. didn't used to be like that.
I mean, it even generates an AI response now,
yes,
which is wasting a lot of water. And, it's crazy that it's actually you're searching for something. What it does, it just starts a nuclear plant to calculate your
yes.
your answer, which is insane, right? It doesn't make sense.
It's absurd. And then I was checking it a few days ago because it showed up in my results also, and then mm-hmm. it's basically generating an AI response based on very dubious sources. Mm-hmm. At least it puts the sources next to it, but then you see, like, come on, how you would never, as a journalist, you would never choose that source because it has, mm-hmm. it's just some random person, or not even, it may even be an AI generated source that the AI bases itself on.
Exactly.
So I kind of checked like what is low tech and how you make mm-hmm. a solar power website. So I made all these things that I know that it's going to take content from my own website. And yeah, it's I wouldn't trust in it based on those experiments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I also use a dumb phone. Great. I'm doing lots of experience with it. My trick is I still have a smartphone, but the smartphone is on my table here. And honestly, I would love, this is a very question that is related to how I can achieve that goal. But I would like to know, how do you, for example, deal with banking and all these things that require this two-factor authentication? I mean, there, for example, I went to my bank and I asked them, like, do I need an application to install it from my smartphone to make banking online? And she said, yes. I said, okay, well, that needs to be a way that I don't have to come to the bank. And she said, no, there's no way, you need a smartphone. How do you deal with that? Do you go to the bank? And I mean, it's causing a lot of extra work, right?
Yeah, for sure. But concerning the banking app, I think I was lucky that I already had my bank account before this started. So one day I got a call from them
mm-hmm.
that I should get a smartphone and that they even wanted to give it to me for free. And I said, no, if I have to switch to a smartphone, I'm going to look for another bank. And then they allowed me, they said, okay, you can keep working with the old system, which mm-hmm. is extremely cumbersome because they make it very hard for me.
Wow.
So I have this card with numbers and codes, and then I get SMS, like text messages. But just making a payment, yeah, it's kind of a hassle.
Mm-hmm.
And not just that, with more and more things like train tickets, because I travel a lot by train. So one of the big problems I have is that, for instance, in Belgium, if you wanna, you cannot buy a ticket in, say, at the counter anymore. You cannot order a ticket to a person,
mm-hmm.
or there's just one guy left, and there's a huge line in front,
mm-hmm.
and then you. For the last years, you were supposed to go to the machines that are standing in the station, but they're also disappearing now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in Antwerp, there's only one or two machines left. So mm-hmm. what they want is that you download your ticket on your smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are still people without smartphones. So what I do now, the Netherlands is also complicated because you have to get in and out of the train station, you need to cross a gate. So I buy my ticket online the day mm-hmm. before I leave or the hour before I leave. I download the PDF of the ticket on my laptop. And then when I have to enter the station, I have to open my laptop, turn it on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm standing there like trying with the QR code that's on my screen, I try to open the gate, which usually doesn't work because my computer is pretty old and it's not mm-hmm. bright enough.
Mm-hmm.
So then I either...
but you can print it, right? You can print it out.
Yes, that's what they tell me, as if I'm traveling with a printer on my back. You
know? Oh, my...
then it takes me another half an hour to go look for a print shop who also don't exist.
Yeah,
there's not many of them left. You had all these internet cafes everywhere, but mm-hmm. they're gone. So, mm-hmm. I'm there, and then or there is like you can press a button and then you can talk to a person, and then I have to explain, and then they never get it. So it leads to absurd, like living without a mm-hmm. smartphone. It makes your life definitely interesting because all these things that for other people are very like. Nothing special for me are like an adventure, trying to get into a train station or trying to get out.
That's what I wanted to speak about with you, because in the podcast with Nate Hagens, The Great Simplification, you said that there is no low-tech life in a high-tech world, right? I mean, it is possible to some extent, but it's the system forces you in many places. I mean, you are like excellent in that. I don't know anyone who goes that deep and like does it that well as you, but the system forces you to get more high tech. Maybe at some point, maybe you by a smartphone? I don't know. Is it the option?
No, never. No, but I disagree that I'm not the I know people who went much further than I. They just disconnect from the whole system. So they go live in a forest and they don't even use electricity. So you can go low tech, but you completely isolate yourself from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that I can do it without, while say living still in a city and everything, is because I write about it, and everything that happens to me, I can then, it's inspiration. I can talk about it in interviews like now, or I can write about it. So, but I won't judge anyone else for having a smartphone or flying or whatever, because the system pushes you into that direction and it pushes you very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, this, I travel by train, but I'm usually traveling by my own. Often the trip is paid by someone who invites me for a congress or something.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a family of four and you go on a trip and you see the price for the train, you're going to be like, well, I cannot afford that.
Mm.
It's very simple. You take the plane or you take the bus, but you're not going to take the train. So this whole blah, blah about we should live more sustainable, yeah, well, make a system that actually encourages people to make the right choices and not to they have to go against the whole system. That's never going to work.
Yeah. But at the same time, I find it like we were speaking about this utopian internet. Imagine that would be something like people would see it the way you see it. Like, okay, it's an amazing challenge to find ways to go through all these problems and try to find fixes. Well, this, like, imagine an internet independent of big tech, blocks connected with each other. Everybody's linking to the other person. And I mean, we could do something like iFixit did. They did it with YouTube tutorials in the beginning. But I mean, imagine an archive and database of people who write tutorials how to go through specific problems and like offer fixes about that. That could be a culture, right? That could be something that people are excited to learn about, and that would be amazing, I think.
Yeah, and in a way, like Wikipedia is still a good example of that.
Yeah,
which they also tried to kill, but Wikipedia is a huge communal effort. It's the commons, very beautiful example. Like these platforms we had in the late 2000s, like Blogger and TypeBit and everything, that we have something similar for like more adapted to these times, like a kind of static site generator platform that is easy to use. Because the problem with this, so we made this solar power website, which is a static website, like the websites in the 90s were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful technology. It's just that to build a static site, you still, at the moment, you still need to know kind of how websites work. You have to know some codes, some coding. And like in the team that built solar powered website, there was this discussion between either people should learn how to code, because we all use computers but we don't know how they work, and or we need a more user-friendly way to build static websites.
Yes.
And I think both make sense. So we should all get a bit more aware of how websites work. But as long as you have to hand code your website to have something, that's, you cannot expect the whole world to follow, I'm afraid. People just don't have the time for that.
So we actually
thought that after launching the solar power website, someone would take that idea and make a kind of user-friendly platform, but it didn't happen yet.
I would argue because I'm also working with Hugo to like this static site generator that you use. I also make lots of experiments with it, and when I need a quick, want to draft a new project, I use Hugo for that. I believe that there are some things we should teach in schools that are like the very basic formats, the very basics of how things work. Like, for example, writing in Markdown. is something that makes you completely independent from Word or these programs. Writing a little bit of HTML. We could also have, I heard, for example, that in Germany we were discussing if it was in Austria where they were discussing to introduce Ubuntu to the public, how is it called? Like,
public institutions and
public institutions, exactly. They are now completely married to Microsoft.
Yeah.
And what they did is, well, in the end, it didn't really work out. I know that Barcelona did it. Barcelona is actually running on Ubuntu, which is amazing. But what they did is they had these runners on the floor or in the building that were actually like consultants for, you know, solving small problems. And but in the end, there was still so much friction that they said, okay, we cannot really do this because people are, I think it's a mindset. It's a problem in the mindset because it's not so hard to create a Hugo website if you have a friend who can tell you how it works, right? Of course, there's less convenience, but it's still possible. Your website, by the way, is complicated because you have many languages, you have these dithering algorithm that runs over all these images and stuff. Like it's a different build process, but creating a simple website is not super difficult with a template that you can use.
But the thing is what you say that we do teach say computer software in schools and outside schools, but the problem is that like my mom also goes to computer classes for years, but then when I ask what they are they actually teaching, they are teaching how to use Microsoft products.
Yes.
And exactly. It teaches you nothing. It just and on top of that, Microsoft changes its software every 2 years or something. So you have to relearn everything again. All the buttons have changed. I remember even from when I was in school, we also got computer classes. It's long ago. Mm-hmm. But it was also that it was you don't really learn how they don't really teach you how to use how a computer or a website works. They teach you how to use commercial software.
Exactly.
And that every school, every public institution, they all should run on Linux or Linux, obviously, because
absolutely. It's
for free. It works better. It doesn't change so often. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's money and power. That's at least where we should start to get rid of those commercial contracts for public institutions.
Absolutely. I think it's a cultural shift as well. Like people should, see it happening a bit right now because people are so pissed off of all these big tech companies right now. I mean, not those in the center of the society maybe, but I see many people kind of being very annoyed and thinking about alternatives, which seem to be not there, but we have to think differently, I think. We have to just downgrade everything to the core and see where we can go from there.
Yeah, people get annoyed by it because it gets worse and worse. Like before, at least when you had to kind of buy software in a cardboard box, you had the choice to keep working with the old operating system because you just kept it using for as long as possible.
Yes.
Until things broke down. But now you have to pay, you have to rent it. And so it's no longer you deciding when you upgrade your software. It's the software manufacturer who decides when you upgrade to a new version. Mm-hmm. And so you lose this freedom to keep working with the older software version.
Yeah.
And that's important too, because from the moment Microsoft upgrades your operating system, there may be other softwares you have to upgrade to, because they're not compatible anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very happy I got rid of Microsoft. And for some years, I still had one laptop with Microsoft Windows 7 because some things didn't work. My printer didn't work with Linux, and then the Skype didn't work. Mm-hmm. But Skype is gone. I don't print anymore. I go to the print shop around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And so no more Windows.
So are you still working on this ThinkPad X60, this very old one, 32-bit computer?
No, I had to upgrade because even Linux is not completely future proof in that sense. So the problem with this this model was that it's a 32-bit computer.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the Linux systems that I was using stopped the support for 32-bit systems. And I could have moved to another kind of more, even more obscure in Linux operating system. But I also thought, well, maybe it also got very hot and the computer, I had to kind of constantly cool it. So I upgraded to a 2010 ThinkPad, which is looks very similar. It's just a little bit newer and it has a webcam. So that was also interesting.
Ah, I used this ThinkPad. I have two of them here. I used the ThinkPad X260. Yeah.
Ah, yeah, that's probably a newer one.
It was, I think, $120, something like that. And I used it also for creating artworks for design festivals. And I always told the story about this computer and that people seem to like it.
Yeah, mine is the X201.
Maybe one last question or one last topic, because I'm really interested in that. What was the thing that made you so, well, we could say like obsessed is a negatively sounding term, but I find it very positive, and I think it is amazing to see how you do it. What made you so interested in low tech? I mean, I know that you was working as a journalist and was frustrated about the positive tone of voice that was actually being expected from you, but like thinking that and going that way that you went that radically and that consistently is another thing. What motivates you?
Yeah, it's a hard question, but I do think, I mean, there's more reasons, but definitely my experience as a, say, high-tech journalist played a big role. I mean, high-tech journalists in the sense that they, at the newspaper and the magazine that I worked for, they sent me I had to kind of report on the newest innovations and technologies and discoveries and science, a lot of science also. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, but I was very critical. And the questions I posed to the scientists or the researchers, engineers, were critical. And very often, I kind of, like, I don't know, I just remember something about the alga fuel. There was this, I've seen all these hypes coming and going. And after a while, you start seeing a pattern. And that period, for instance, we believe that we're going to run the whole world on alga fuel. And we're going to grow.
Don't know what that is, actually.
Yeah, it's like these things that grow in the sea and in ponds, like blooming alga. And that could have been converted into... So, okay, and it was a hype, like we had a hype about hydrogen cars, electric cars, renewable solar panels. And every time it's going to solve everything. But then when you pose the right questions, like, for instance, a very relevant question when you make something like a fuel from algas, like how many energy do you put in? So that kind of questions I put in front of the scientists, and they were like, well, yeah, actually we put more in than comes out. And I'm like, okay, but what are you doing? And so I wrote that in my article. So I wrote the whole story, and then I ended with that questions like, yeah, this is not going to work. And after a while at the newspaper, they actually told me that, like, Chris, we love your articles, but you always conclude it's not going to work. And that's when I realized, it's like, yeah, but it's not because it's not my opinion. It's just the consequence of the critical questions I ask, and it's not going to work. So I really started realizing that what are we actually trying to do? We're trying to solve all these problems created by technology, by creating new technologies that then pretend to gonna solve that, and maybe sometimes they do for a while, but then they create 10 other problems, and it's a mindset. And that's why I felt very confident that I discovered something that is that you can actually build a whole magazine around. And you just turn everything upside down, and rather than being like completely uncritical about new technologies, which is what the typical technology or science article in a newspaper is, just so like uncritical. And
or it is always, a doomsday. It is a doomsday message. That's also very popular
that's
right
more,
now.
Yeah, that's more recent.
Yeah, true.
Indeed. But in those times, it was all just technology is going to save us.
Hmm.
And also another thing, like I found like the typical technology page in a newspaper is like the newest iPhone. I'm like, okay, who cares? And then at the same time, I discovered that there was so much interesting technology that happened in the past, and which I found much more fascinating, how people did things before. And that was completely missing from the tech pages in the media, because it has to be new. So it's really like this mindset, this belief. I think it's a kind of a religion. So we kind of got rid of religion. Like, we don't believe in God anymore. The church has lost its power. And so now we believe in technology. And I don't say we have to go back to the church, but I do see a lot of similarities between organized religion and the belief in technical solutions.
Exactly.
And so I found it, I was confident enough that it would work to have a magazine that goes against all this. And once I did, I quickly noticed from the feedback that I was right.
Mm-hmm.
And also that I was absolutely not the first to think like that. So when I started Low Tech Magazine, I was not aware of this whole tradition in philosophy. And like, there's a lot of people for like at least 150 years who are kind of doing the same what I'm doing. And I got to know all these people through starting Low Tech Magazine. And that made me even more confident, in the sense that it was based on my own feel, my intuition and my knowledge of these 10 years of journalism. But at the same time, I see that other people that I was unaware of had very much the same feeling. So I feel that, there is something important there that is also growing. Because when I started in 2007, I remember doing some talks that people just laughed at me. That doesn't happen anymore. I mean, I work with universities. There's big names following the blog. I mean, things really change. So it's no longer, you can actually be critical of technology. And I think the smartphone has a lot to do with that, because the smartphone really, many people feel that they are addicted to it. Everyone I talk to is like, oh, I wish I could do what you do, having this smartphone. So before, there was not this type of technology that people were really bothered about. Like, okay, cars, like, I really hate cars. But people, when I say that, people are not like, oh, I wish I could live without a car. No, they look at me like, come on, man, just get into a car. Mm-hmm. Cars are great. But with smartphones, people kind of, the message that technology can also have a bad influence, I think it came home there.
The point you made with the religion or the myth is also something that Julia Watson puts out in her amazing book, Low Tech. I think, have you heard of that? Probably you know it.
Right? Yeah, I heard, but I didn't read it yet.
I find it very interesting. I mean, she's speaking a lot about indigenous wisdom, about radical indigenous, designed by radical indigenism. And that also the argument I find very convincing is that she says, well, if we are living in a myth of technology, why don't we think about what kind of better myth we could create about that? And we can find inspiration in the Iroquois, for example, who have this amazing seventh generations principle, which looks very far into the future. So that's a book I find very cool as well, because it is designed in a way that is loved by people who are actually in a different milieu, you know? So it looks very precious, valuable. It is expensive. Like, it has these bronze colors and stuff. Like, that's something I find very interesting as a bridge into the, not mainstream, but into other areas.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't read it, but I also think, maybe she talks about that also, but like, before you had organized religion, you had, say, the pagan beliefs. You had mostly nature was seen as God, like a tree was holy and nature was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the Romans, even for a long time, had natural religion. So they believed nature was their God. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because if a tree is holy, you're not going to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
And you may use some of its branches, but you're not going to kill the thing, because it's your grandparents or whatever. And because we humans need something to believe in, and that we cannot change that. So organized religion, I don't want to go back to the times of the Catholic Church.
No.
Thank you. But I also think that believing in technology is very much not making us happy, and it's destroying our future.
Mm.
But the question is indeed what comes in its place, and that's a big task ahead. Like, what are we gonna believe in? What we gonna believe?
Mm.
What's the meaning of life? And but this religious aspect, like you have this transhuman in these experiments where they want to live forever and stuff like that. All these billionaires, I mean, it's crazy. It makes no sense. Religious.
It is very religious, exactly. Like, they want to be like the super intelligence in their brain with chips and AI, and like Elon Musk has this company, Neuralink.
Yeah.
This is insane. I just read this amazing book by Douglas Rushkoff called The Survival of the Richest, which is actually a zoom into the world of these people. And I was shocked, actually. Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, I think this is the challenge. We need to create culture. We need to create, like, we have to create a culture of what you are already doing, by the way, a culture around low tech. And as a single human being, I think you're doing an amazing job in creating such a, you know, belief system, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, thanks. But, and it shouldn't be called low tech necessarily, because low tech is also just a label. It's like now in France, it has become this whole movement, and I'm like, but I didn't really meant it. Just, I needed a name for my website. And I think low tech, when I proposed a name in 2007 to some friends, they were very negative about it. They said, like, it sounds negative. And then I thought, like, okay, exactly what I want.
Awesome.
Because it made people uncomfortable in 2007. Like, it sounds like something negative. And I think 10 years later, it became something positive.
Mm-hmm.
But, in the 70s, it was called appropriate technology. Call it soft technology. There's, like, meanwhile, I discovered you can give it a lot of names. It's just...
Yes.
What I think is the most important is to be critical of this myth of technological progress and technological solutions. How you call it doesn't matter, but we have to go against that.
Yeah.
And just not accept, like, okay, that's how it is. No, that's not how it is. That's how what the world became, and that's what the system created after 500 years of capitalism. But there have been other societies that worked in very different ways, and we can have, again, societies that work according to very different principles.
Absolutely. That was a great roundup. Thank you so much, Chris. It was amazing to have you in this podcast. And I wish you all the best. And I look forward to see you maybe on a talk when I'm in Barcelona again. Great. Let's see.
Yeah, always welcome.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you want to support this podcast, please go to demystifytechnology.substack.com and become a member. I wish you a wonderful day.